Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in African American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Omari Everett Phillips, the host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Lorenzo Costaguda about his new book, Workers of All Colors Unite, Race and the Origins of American Socialism. Dr. Lorenzo Costaguda, welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone, and thank you very much for having me here.
Absolutely. We love having you here. And so, Dr. Costaguda, I wonder if you could just begin the interview just by telling us a bit about yourself.
Yeah, sure. I'm originally from Italy. I did my BA and a master's in Italy, and then I've been living in the UK for around 10 or a bit more years. And in this time, I did my PhD here in the UK and I got a job. And then I ended up writing a book about the US, and people are very confused about all these different origins and like nationalities involved in this project. But hopefully we'll get a chance to talk about this.
Absolutely. And I have to ask you, what do you think of the UK being there for 10 years? How do you like it?
I like it very much. I'm very, very happy in the academic environment. I think it's great. We've had a bit of problems recently. But only with Brexit and all that. But all in all, things are actually very, very good. It's a great place to work with many connections with the United States, that being a lecturer in United States history, it's kind of very important. So it's a great situation, really.
Awesome. Well, talking about this work, how did you come to this project?
Well, there is a lot to say about this question. It's been in the making for a long time. I want to start by saying two things that are more connected as I was just mentioning to my personal biography, and one that is more connected to the way in which practically I get to this project. The first two are more like, I've always had a sort of a fascination for the history of the left. I come from a country that used to have the largest communist party in Western Europe, with a very strong tradition of like radicalism. And that kind of filtered through in my decisions on what to focus on for my undergrad and postgraduate dissertations, really. I added to that a focus on the United States. And I came to this from the angle of like trying to understand the old conundrum, like the big capitalist country that doesn't have apparently like a socialist party, a labor party, a strong left-wing tradition. And that was really something that spiked my attention when I was trying to figuring out what to focus on for my research. When I moved to the UK and when I started talking with my supervisor at the University of Nottingham, which is Dr. Christopher Phelps, he kind of added, I was already focused on like the period of the Gilded Age. I liked that period because I thought it was the moment in which American capitalism becomes what it is now to a certain extent. Kind of, that's the moment in which the country goes from like being a kind of a rural environment to be a globally significant industrial superpower. So that was the period. I was fascinated by all the problems connected to immigration and to the role of immigrants in the country in turning the US into a capitalist superpower. But at the same time, and this is like the contribution of my supervisor, he was like, you cannot really have a project on like socialism, immigration, without adding a significant angle on race. And he was absolutely right. I mean, 100%. I don't know how I missed that, but then looking at my background, I kind of understand. There is a very strange situation when you talk about race, being in Europe, especially certain parts of Europe, or being in the US, the conversation is very different. Not so much in the UK. The UK is a bit of an in-between place between the two, continental Europe and the US. But like, for example, in Italy, you still get a lot of like, even today, the idea that people shouldn't be talking about race at all. Race is really something in the past, linked to biological ideologies of race, and like we shouldn't really be having a conversation about it. I haven't presented my book in Italy, but I'm absolutely sure that when I go and do that, people will be asking, why do you have the word race in the title? And so I came to this topic with these two kind of fascinations that come from my own personal background. But then when it comes to like defining the type of sources that I use and the specificity of my book, there is another like element to add, which is I started this project with a slightly different idea in mind. It was more like a collective biography of several leaders of the Socialist Labour Party. We are going to mention more details about it, but it's the party that is founded in 1876. It's like the first socialist party founded in the US with a national dimension. And I wanted to do this collective biography. And when I hit the archives, I realized that the project that I had in mind was not really feasible. But there was another project there sitting and waiting for someone to be picked up and be done, which was a project based on the labor press and the socialist press, where there was a massive ongoing conversation about race and about the problems that race was creating on the workplace. And by reading through these like multitudes of local newspapers, which were, historians of the 19th century don't know this very well, were the ways in which people were talking to each other. It was very lively as a debate opportunity. Reading through these columns of like newspapers in German especially, but also in English, I figured out that there you had really a conversation that needed to be reconstructed on the relationship between problems connected to race and the developing of an American socialist movement.
And so early in your work, you actually separate out these sort of two ways you say that highlight how socialists approach racial diversity. Can you take us through what those two ways are?
Yeah, I speak about like areas of opinion. These are like two broad ways of in which socialists in the SLP approach the problem of race. The first one, I term it in the book scientific racialism. I use the term racialism rather than racism because I want to make a distinction that I'm going to explain in a second. But the idea for this like large groups of socialists is that what they do is essentially taking the theories of race of the time, which is a bit of a patchwork of several different ideologies. It can be Darwinism, it can be social Darwinism, it can be anthropology at some point, it can be eugenics, even though the Gilded Age is a bit early for that. And they kind of use that as essentially scientific evidence, because at the time, this evolutionist, strongly evolutionist set of theories is very much perceived as like the cutting edge scientific approach of the time. And they kind of say, we need to find a way to square this scientific evidence with Marxism. These people tend to be all Marxist. And so they try to find a way to integrate these two mismatching ideologies. And this is one group. The other group, I term them internationalists. And they are normally former members of the First International, the organization started by Marx and others in London in 1864. they come from a background in which trade unionism is very important. They want to focus extensively on class rather than race. They understand class is much more important than race. They actually say we need to be focusing on class and leave race aside. And so you have these two groups that really clash with one another in the SLP. And this is essentially the history that I tell in the book.
How, with these two positions, how does this reflect sort of this overall socialist position on class organization? And also, how does it sort of affect the overall argument that you have for your work?
Yeah, I make the point that there is a sort of a clear link between the ways in which these two positions are articulated and the ways in which the party behaves, or like the history of the party develops across the Gilded Age. On the one hand, you have the scientific rationalists whose goal tends to be trying to be more in touch and closer to the positions that you find on the ground. This is a moment in which Chinese, anti-Chinese sentiments are at the very peak. Nativism is very much present. And therefore, these people, they tend to be people that want to run at the elections and that want to have a kind of an electoral politics strategy for the party. And therefore, these approaches that are kind of flirting in one way or another with these scientific theories of race, they tend to be much more compatible with running on the ballot, because they kind of go in line with the positions that you find among the voting communities in the areas in which the SLP is radicated, that tend to be in the Northeast and the Midwest, and the West as well, even though not so much. We are talking about mostly white voters that are attuned with this idea that we should be focusing on whites and not necessarily on racial minorities. On the other hand, you have the internationalists whose strategy is really incompatible with this approach. They tend to be focusing more on trade unionism. Not because they want to run away from electoral politics. They tend not to believe in electoral politics. They tend not to believe, to be convinced that democracy and the way in which it works in the United States is really compatible with achieving any sort of like class equality, which is what they aim at. What they think is much more important focusing on improving the working conditions of people. And in this way, this is like the link with race, you kind of lift everyone up. So you can have an appeal that goes across racial lines, and you don't really need to go after the ideologies that you find, but you can really be consistent with your message of equality. So by focusing on class and by leaving race aside, you can really be consistent with working class internationalism. But you can only do that in the context of Gilded Age United States through trade unionism and not through the ballot box.
And so at points in time in the book, you sort of view the history of socialism in the United States through leaders of the movement and leaders of the party, right? So I'm wondering, why did you make the decision to sort of look at these leaders? And what do we learn about sort of these shifting ideas of race and racial integration by viewing sort of the actions that these leaders take?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, focusing on leaders to an extent was a necessity, because I was dealing with sources that were not really helpful in trying to reconstruct the rank and file. I mean, I started with this project with the idea of like trying to understand what was going on at different levels in the socialist community in general terms. But the only like individuals I could focus on, for the mere fact that when you look at newspapers and 19th century newspaper, I understand, Omar, you also are a 19th century historian, so you know the problem well. You look at these articles and they are never signed. And so mapping really the opinions of individual members that were not the leaders was kind of very difficult, if not impossible. This party that I was focusing on, the SLPs, a small party, didn't keep any list of members. So you kind of know some, you know the individualities, you kind of know some of the leaders, not just the big, the important leaders, but many. But tracing a history that is like something resembling a history from below is really impossible. At least I didn't manage to do that. But at the same time, what I did was like picking leaders that were giving opinions and like different types of positions. And the other thing that I did, which I do very often in the book, is like using letters or using like sources from coming from the rank and file responses so that you can trace the debate. And it's not just the voices of the leaders, but it's also like what is going on at the base level and how they are kind of responding to that. And in this way, it kind of helped me to trace the history of the institution. I try to balance like intellectual and institutional history in this book. And that's focusing on the leaders helped me telling the history of what is going on in the party.
Yeah. Did you find that hard to sort of balance the like intellectual like and institutional portions of this history? And how did you ultimately sort of get to a point where you're like, this is the sort of ratio that I like or that I want in this narrative?
Yeah, I struggled. I struggled because at the very beginning, I was kind of interested. I've always been interested in institutional history of the party. But at the same time, I kind of understood that there were this racial conversation on race and debate about ideas was to an extent much more relevant because it allowed my story to be in touch with much broader issues that are ongoing at the time. I mean, the kind of questions that these people are trying to answer are the same questions that people in different institutions, organizations, and across the entire spectrum of the American working class, people are trying to solve. Whereas the history of the SLP, which ultimately is a small party, is something that might be relevant for people that study Marxism or the left, but it's sort of a secondary story in a moment in which there are other left-wing organizations that are much more powerful and influential than the SLP. So I tried to kind of balance the two, keeping in mind these priorities, even though there was a moment in which I was much more on the institutional, but then I realized that that didn't really make sense and I rebalanced the two.
Wonderful. So let's talk a little bit about the organization of this book then. So in chapter one, you look at sort of socialist ideas of race, ethnicity, both sort of before the Civil War and then also after the Civil War. It's a really fascinating chapter. Can you take us through how socialists viewed the connection between sort of socialism and race, both before and after Reconstruction?
I mean, in this chapter, I try to like explain the way in which this connection between socialism and race was really changing at the time. Before the Civil War, the point I make is, I mean, the first point is like internal to the development of the left in the United States, but also globally. This book tends to trace the way in which especially the Marxist left develops in the United States. But for the antebellum period, talking about a Marxist left doesn't really make sense. Socialism in that moment is really like a mixed bag of different approaches coming from Europe and developing in different ways, also on the basis of the context of what people, mainly immigrants, were finding when they were arriving in the United States. So I used different leaders to kind of explain the different positions. But the broad point that I make is that in this period, the conversation about race within the broad area of the socialist movement is very much linked to slavery, which is unsurprising. But slavery is absolutely pivotal for this generation of people that tend to be German immigrants. They arrive to the United States. They come from a background of radicalism. They are Republican, small r. They are supporters of democracy. They are supporters of equality. they arrive to the United States and they cling to the battle against slavery as a way to kind of use the radicalism that they are bringing from Europe. In Europe, it was very much a battle against authoritarianism. It was a battle for democracy. The target in the US changes, and the target in the US tends to become slavery. These people are also anti-racist. So they are not just against slavery in itself. They are anti-racist as well. They tend to see things through the prism of class, but they are unified by having a common target, which is what you see missing in the postbellum period. Because as long as there is a target, which is the abolition of slavery, these people kind of stick together. And what they say can be told in a kind of a unified way. What happens afterwards is complicated, and it's linked to the many complications that you have ongoing in Reconstruction in the United States. What happens is there isn't a consolidation, an institutional consolidation of what is happening in the left, German immigrant left, inspired by Marxism, by early Marxism in the United States, because the First International is founded, and that is an institution that kind of attracts people that verge in that political area. But the First International is a kind of a difficult moment, if you want. To a certain extent, the problem is that members of the First International, they tend to go along with that trend that is very common after the Civil War. It's very common in the trade unions. It's very common across the country. The radical republicanism, the idea that is coming from the trade union movement that is developing at the time of like, we have emancipated black labor, now we need to emancipate white labor. Which is to an extent a problematic ideology because it's kind of flattening what was happening to win chattel slavery and at the same time making the implicit logical jump, which is not very logical, that now labor is white, whereas labor isn't white. I mean, labor is like multiracial after the Civil War, and different racial groups have different problems. So in the context of what happens in the socialist movement after the Civil War, you really have like an unclear recognition. Again, an adherence to anti-racist values, but an unclear recognition of the specific circumstances of racial minorities, especially the specific circumstance of the African-American community that is going through a moment that, as we know very well, has much potential, but at the same time is a social condition that is incredibly fragile. Members of the First International don't recognize the importance of voting rights in this moment, or defending voting rights, defending the civil rights of African Americans. They stick to the equality that they were professing before the war. But the way in which that is translated after the Civil War is not as coherent, successful, or like clearly linked to the defense on the ground of racial equality in the same way as it was before the war.
And so chapter two looks at the sort of founding of the SLP in 1876 and the divide in sort of membership that we sort of spoke about earlier. Could you take us through why was there a need to actually create this party? How did this sort of divide happen? And how does this sort of then sort of fit into this larger narrative as we're sort of moving towards the last sort of chapters of this book?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the foundation of the SLP, which is not called the SLP at the beginning, is called Working Men Party of the United States in 1876. It's a bit of a strange story, but very important and kind of forgotten as well. I mean, this is 1876. It's like the country celebrating the centennial. You have a small group of socialist leaders coming from like different parties across the country. They all meet in Philadelphia, of course. And amongst them is the secretary of what has remained, what is left of the First International, which is this guy called Friedrich Sorge. And they meet and they kind of federate these four different parties, including the First International, into this new national organization. This is mapped onto what is going on in Germany. In Germany, at the same time, the supporters of Marx and supporters of LaSalle are federating together in what will become the Social Democratic Party of Germany. And the problem with the US version of that is that from the very beginning, you have this distinction between those that support trade unionism and those that support running at the elections, that is already creating problems. These two factions kind of find an agreement. It is an agreement that it's kind of, I mean, if you read the minutes of the Congress are hilarious, like many, because they kind of get to an agreement at the very last minute, but it's clear that it's not going to hold. Which it doesn't. So it kind of immediately explodes. And you have this debate between people that say, okay, the SLP shouldn't be running at the elections. Absolutely. We should be focusing on trade unionism. And other people that start running at the elections with their small sections in several parts of the country. And curiously, what happens is that 1877, the Great Strike happens. And you would expect the Great Strike to be in favor of the trade unionists and kind of to have that faction winning within the party. But it's actually the other way around. Because what happens with 1877 is that the SLP actually finds itself at the very center of the action in many industrial cities, Chicago, Cincinnati, New York, and St. Louis. And they reap the benefit in terms of like electoral politics. All the candidates that they run, they get voted massively by people that were striking in 1877. And eventually, this has like a significant impact on the party because the people that want to support the electoral ballots are the ones that win the debate within the party. So they remain within the SLP, whereas the people that kind of support trade unionism end up slowly going out of the party. You find this leadership active in other organizations like the Knights of Labor in the 1880s. So you have this strange situation in which you have the SLP that remains stuck with the scientific rationalists, whereas the internationalists kind of, not all of them, but kind of trickle out of the party and they end up in other organizations. So it's a very important shift that explains the history of organized socialism in this moment of the Gilded Age.
Absolutely.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And so chapters 3, 4, and 5 all deal with sort of the some of the sort of prevalent ethnic questions of the 19th century, right? So chapter 3 looks at the Chinese question, chapter 4 looks at sort of the Negro question, and chapter 5 looks at the Indian question. So I'm wondering, can you take us through how socialists navigated and sort of engaged with these different ethnic questions?
Yes. I mean, the first thing to say about this is that with these three chapters, what I try to do is essentially explaining the way in which the it's very difficult to talk about like a race question in US because there are so many. And each of them has different features. And it's kind of very linked to the specific like social, political, economic backgrounds of these communities and like the local circumstances of like these people and how they are involved in what is going on at the time. So talking about race in this moment means talking about a million of different problems. And what I try to do with these three chapters is kind of representing this this diversity. And every now and then I kind of get asked if I can give like an argument for these three together. And it really is impossible because these three are really going in different directions. And the small group of people that I trace in the book, they really behave in different ways according to like the different problems that you talk about. Going in order, I mean, on Chinese immigration and on the Chinese question, the first thing to say is that this is by far the problem that is discussed more by socialists at the time. It's present, it's everywhere in the news all the time. It's no coincidence that 1882 is the year in which the Chinese Exclusion Act is passed. This is the moment in the country in which the conversation is at its peak. But the way in which I discuss and I try to like use the chapter to explain what is going on in the movement is I focus very much on the West Coast where this debate is happening. And of course, there you have the success of the Working Men's Party of California, which has no relation with the SLP. It's born in like similar circumstances, but the SLP has a very strange relationship with this movement because it's essentially fascinated by the success, because the Working Men's Party in California is doing incredibly well. And it's kind of representing the working class of California. But at the same time, as we all know, the Working Men's Party of California is deeply racist. And its message is very much against Chinese immigration. So, again, this is like encapsulating the problem that those that want to go with the electoral politics have. What do? We go with the people or we stick to our principles? They end up not doing anything and like being kind of caught in between the two positions. But I also use the debate about Chinese immigration to explain the dynamics of racialization of like socialist ideologies. And I do that with a couple of examples of like people that and like members that kind of articulate vehemently the situation of exploitation in which Chinese immigrants find themselves at the time. They are very detailed, and the level of detail and understanding of what is happening in San Francisco and in the communities across the country is much more significant in terms of like giving, explaining what is going on than for many of the other questions that I talk about. So this shows you that kind of socialists have a clear understanding of the dynamic of exploitation that is going on in Chinese communities, which is to an extent a bit more complicated than that, because as we know, the standard accusation is that these people were indentured workers. Even though, again, that's a problematic category because for many Chinese immigrants, coming to the US at the time is an opportunity and they kind of do that because they want to do that and they know it's going to be temporary. They're fine. They are in a in an exploitative dynamic, but the socialist sources have a sort of understanding of this and they kind of understand that there is exploitation ongoing, but they never manage to go past the racial barrier. They never manage to kind of, you have these very detailed articles in which people say, okay, these are exploited workers. And then they end up by saying, and that's why they should go back to China. Which is like, no. Why don't you end up by being logical with your own position and kind of saying, and that's why we need to defend them? No. And that's race operating. It's very clear that that is what is going on. So I use this question to kind of explain how deep racial ideologies are pervading the ways in which socialists at the time think. On African Americans, there is kind of a set of like different questions that I tackle. The SLP, on one hand, is the party, the Socialist Party, that takes a fairly clear stance on the issue. They have a resolution in which they kind of appeal to class solidarity across racial lines, both in the North and in the South. And they kind of endorse this position on class solidarity. There is an African American membership in the SLP, even though it's very difficult to kind of understand the numbers for the problem that I was talking about earlier. But at the same time, there are a set of like missed opportunities. The reality is that of a socialist movement that is mostly active in the areas of the country in which the least amount of African Americans are living at the time. So you have a mismatch in terms of socialist movement being very strong in the North and in the industrial cities in the Midwest, in a moment in which more than 90% of African Americans are still in the South, and in the South, the SLP is non-existent at all. But at the same time, I kind of, on basis on this reality, what I did was kind of looking at these circumstances in which this pattern was kind of breaking up. And places like New Orleans, for example, or St. Louis, or Cincinnati, so like industrial city in the South, or cities on like the border, in which you have sizable African-American communities and a strong presence, especially in St. Louis and in Cincinnati, of African-Americans and the SLP as well. So looking at these cities, you kind of see that in some cases, for example, in Cincinnati, you have the very interesting and fascinating leadership of Peter H. Clark, who is probably the first African-American socialist that is member of the National Executive Committee. Is kind of very present in the life of the party, but he's the typical character that, despite being very much on board with the idea that you need to tackle together race and class, and explaining that in incredibly clear terms, is also the leader that knows that if you want to tackle the problems of the African American community, you cannot do that from within a party that is too weak to defend the position and the rights of African Americans. And at the same time, you see what is going on the other side, like a party that is very much German, very immigrant, and is kind of dealing with different set of problems, and is not prioritizing what is going on in the African American communities, and essentially not understanding the specific situation in which African Americans are. So I try to explain this in a kind of very regional and local way to kind of reconstruct the broader dynamic of what is happening. I say a couple of words about Native Americans and then I wrap up because I've been talking for quite a long time now. On Native Americans, this is like a fascinating and very important aspect of the problem. And I kind of divide the chapter into two. On one hand, I want to make clear the fact that socialists use very often clearly anti-colonial language to defend the rights of Native Americans on the frontier. I mean, the Gilded Age, as we know, is the moment in which the frontier is allegedly closed by the end of it. Even though that doesn't really mean much because the clashes continue everywhere. Native Americans are still there. The frontier is like an imagined idea that we owe to Turner, but that doesn't really have a significance. But what the socialists see is the fact that from their own perspective, this rhetoric that is very much around at the time of like, Native Americans being savage doesn't really square with what they see in capitalist America. So what they say is like they flip the script and they say, actually, these people, Native American people, are the civilized one because they've been untouched by the savagism that is unleashed on our society by capitalism. So it's like a rhetorical move, but it's incredibly powerful in articulating an anti-capitalist message. So you have a lot of that in what socialists write at the time about the question. But at the same time, you also have that framework that I was talking about at the beginning, the evolutionary idea, the idea that kind of human beings develop according to like different stages. And you go from like barbarism and savagism to civilization. So it's this framework that is very much in contradiction with the previous rhetoric about savagism and capitalism and so on and so forth. But that socialists struggle enormously to step outside, because essentially there is no any sense of like cultural relativism existing. And therefore, for them, really moving outside the idea that you can interpret or understand Native American communities as something different, that doesn't need to be placed on the same single direction, developmental path in which other cultures of the world are, is something that no one really, from my reading of the sources and from my findings, managed to articulate as a position in the socialist movement. One thing to wrap up, despite my attempts in these three chapters, the focus and the voices of the people that are speaking are very much the socialists rather than Native Americans in chapter 5 or Chinese immigrants in chapter 3. It's a bit different in chapter 4. It's a struggle in terms of like limitations of the sources themselves. And so the gaze is like people talking about these questions more than an exchange that, for my finding, didn't really happen. So.
And so chapter 6 then looks at sort of a very understudied period of time in U.S. history in terms of the 1890s and the way the SLP moves from an immigrant party to what you describe as sort of a bit more mature, sort of English-speaking, nationally organized party. And so I'm wondering, what sort of role does this shift have on the party, the movement, and also these ideas of sort of racial integration as well?
Yeah, there is a major shift in what is going on in the party, which reflects on what is happening in the country in general. This is a moment in which like immigration is taking momentum, but it's also coming from different parts of Europe and the world, which also means that certain communities that were at the very center of the party, like the German community or the Jewish community, are kind of growing in importance and becoming more integrated, and that favors the creation of a sort of a multi-ethnic coalition. You have like the English-speaking workers that are kind of coming in the movement and like making the ideology, the socialist ideology, much more Americanized, and German groups that stop being like maybe isolated and they kind of become much more important in the social fabric of the time. I also argue that this kind of provokes a change in the way in which race is interpreted and understood within the party. And this debate between like the scientific rationalists and the working class internationalists is solved to an extent with a much more clear adherence to the second position. So a class-focused socialism becomes really what the ideology that is organizing the SLP in the 1890s. It is due to the fact a change in leadership, a leadership that is much more openly Marxist, embracing a version of Marxism that is not a pure version of Marxism, which doesn't exist, by the way, but like a sort of like a very specific version in which this focus on class is very important. And at the same time, yeah, like the Americanization of the party and like this creation of a like multi-ethnic communities, what is making the party in the 1890s much more important, much more relevant on the scene, much more present. But at the same time, I also argue by the end of the 1890s, it's this precarious equilibrium and the falling apart of this precarious equilibrium that is kind of putting an end to a period of significance of the SLP and transitioning into the next phase of what the socialist movement in the US is, which I don't cover in the book. I cover in the conclusions. You want me to say something on the conclusions?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Go ahead. Go for it. Yeah.
I mean, the key date here is 1899, which is the moment in which the SLP as a party kind of split, falls apart. And the way in which it falls apart is by like forcing very much on the Americanization of the party. There is a leader in particular, Daniel DeLeon, that is very much focusing on that with very problematic takes and many policies. But also, I argue, on this like makeup, ethnic and racial makeup of the party. By trying to impose a very rigid version of Marxism into the party, he provokes a split that leads essentially the SLP to divide into two groups. One of them would be joining Debs and a group of other socialists in the Socialist Party of America that is founded in 1901. And that is really the party that leads the next phase of American socialism. I argue that there is a clear line that goes from the SLP to the SPA in terms of like embracing this idea that class should be the main focus with some kind of attention to what is going on to the racial minorities that remains, is there in the SLP and remains in the SPA as well.
And so what sort of audience did you imagine for this work?
I mean, the first audience that I have in mind, of course, is academics interested in a range of issues that could be like labor, race, the history of radicalism, the history of socialism, the history of the Gilded Age, like different periods. I hope that this book will interest also scholars that do like German history, for example. There is a lot of like German immigrants in the book, as you know, and like immigration studies in general. But I also hope that is a book that it could be interesting for people that are not in academia, but want to learn a bit more about the background, especially the background of like in terms of radical movements, racial relations in the country, and so on and so forth. I think it has a message that kind of goes beyond the specific academic messages and like arguments that you can find in the book.
Absolutely. And what do you want readers to take away from your book?
I would say, I mean, I'm going to be slightly controversial here, but I started with the idea of like the problem of like the United States not having a socialist party and the problem of the US not having a left. I think that the point that one of the strongest points that I want to make in the book is that actually that's not true. I mean, the US is a massive and fascinating history on the left. And it's a history that is incredibly important, not only for what happens in the US, but for what happens across the world. It's very necessary to kind of link what happens in the United States with what is happening in Europe and other parts of the world. Because, I mean, we talk about a moment in which imperialism, empires, and like colonization is rife across the world. The Gilded Age, I mean, if you step outside from the US, you don't call it the Gilded Age, you call it the Victorian era, you call it whatever, the Belle Epoque, or whatever you want to call it. But the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century are a crucial moment in which so many global dynamics are ongoing. And this is a story that needs to be placed in that context. So what I want people to take away from the book is the fact that the US has a specific history of the left, and that history of the left is important on so many different levels.
Absolutely. And I think you do a wonderful job of sort of highlighting that throughout the book. Well, Dr. Costaguda, we've taken up a lot of your time. Thank you for that. So I'll just ask one last question here. What are you working on now?
Well, it's to an extent, it's linked to what I was saying earlier, what I'm working at the moment, because it's what I want to do with my next project and potentially at some point next book is essentially telling this history about how conversations on race are ongoing, not just in the American socialist movement, but also in European socialist movement and in the global left in this period. So what I would like to tell is a story that places the US in the broader scheme of things and very much place this conversation about race on one side in that broader conversation about evolutionism and theories of race, but on the other side, on like colonialism and anti-imperialism. If you move back, we end from where we start. I mean, if you switch back to Europe in this moment, the conversation on race, my impression is that it doesn't happen in the workplace in the same way as it happens in the US, but it happens in the conversation in the context of imperialism. So it's like a projected conversation, because the racial and social makeup of many European countries is different at the time, but they are all, many of them at least, they are all involved in imperial missions across the world. So you have to kind of patch together this history to understand better differences on the two sides of the Atlantic, but also link this to the developing of a global left at the time.
That sounds wonderful. It sounds like a great project, and I'll definitely look out for it. I hope that some of the readers do or some of the listeners do as well. Well, Dr. Costaguda, thank you for being on the show today. It was a wonderful conversation. It's a great book, and I really enjoyed our conversation today. So take care.
Thank you very much for having me here.
Absolutely.